You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The subject is Legends. Powerhouse by Keziah Weir. Opening photograph by Paolo Roversi. Giorgio Armani photographed at the Armani headquarters in Milan. In the first moments of Giorgio Armani's favorite film, Alfred Hitchcock's 1946 romantic thriller Notorious, a young woman exits a Miami courtroom through a gauntlet of flashbulbs. Played by Ingrid Bergman, the woman is statuesque, her expression enigmatic, her ensemble aesthetically impeccable. A creamy jacket, coupled with a wide hat and high-necked blouse, both black and dotted with glittering stones. It's clear why this movie, a paean to elegance and outsized personalities, occupies a place in the heart of 84-year-old Mr. Armani, as he's called by everyone in his industry, a self-described film buff who transformed awards season style by eschewing the trendy and provocative in favor of fresh sophistication. Even a marginally perceptive viewer will note the congruence between Bergman's outfit and early iconic Armani looks, all iterations of what would come to be known as power dressing. Diane Keaton's assertively elegant blazer in 1978, Michelle Pfeiffer's luxe suit in navy velvet a decade later, Jodie Foster's silk jacket and beaded trousers in 1992. The only pop of color, a crimson AIDS awareness ribbon pinned to her lapel. The metonymic red carpet may be a far cry from a Florida courthouse, but the demand for flawlessness is about on par. Next photos, Armani at the Oscars, four glorious decades of red carpet style, from the 1970s to the 2010s. In the photos, Diane Keaton, 1978, Michelle Pfeiffer, 1989, Jessica Tandy, 1990, Jessica Lange, 1990, Jodie Foster, 1992, Al Pacino, 1993, Mira Sorvino, 1996, Sharon Stone, 1996, Salma Hayek, 1997, Denzel Washington, 2002, Julia Roberts, 2004, Kate Blanchett, 2007, Anne Hathaway, 2009, Jennifer Lopez, 2010, Reese Witherspoon, 2011, Jessica Chastain, 2013, Naomi Watts, 2013, Viola Davis, 2017, Nicole Kidman, 2018, and Armie Hammer, 2018. Since the brand's earliest days, Armani has enjoyed a happy entanglement with Hollywood. The designer, who draws inspiration from Italian neorealist to American westerns, from Hitchcock to Martin Scorsese, a close friend, has outfitted 200-plus movies, including American Gigolo and The Wolf of Wall Street, and a compounded sum of awards circuit appearances. He's even credited with creating the role of the stylist by installing a savvy in-house celebrity liaison, Wanda McDaniel, at his Rodeo Drive boutique, which opened in 1988. His promise to those who don his designs, whether it's Viola Davis in a dramatic red gown or loyalist Kate Blanchett in a host of confections, she will not regret what she is wearing when she looks at pictures of herself in the press the next day or even next year. It's now more than four decades since Armani's first Oscars carpet. That time was an era of transition, Armani says, and today there are similarities. Once again, the red carpet has become a forum for debate, where Time's Up pins abound, and each gown serves as an amplification of the woman inside it rather than the main event. Which is, he adds, what I have always believed is the secret of great red carpet dressing. Power dressing today reflects a particular look that was fashionable in the 80s. But for me, clothes have always had power, says Armani, the power to make people feel they are at their best. One thinks of the Mona Lisa smile that settles onto Ingrid Bergman's face as she and her perfect clothes sail through the cameras and questions. Armani is still about power dressing, the designer says, dressing to empower.
Thank you.
on to beauty, built to spill. Irving Penn's 1947 theater accident immortalized a klutz moment in an iconic photograph. With a red carpet twist, this homage winks at the season's buzziest films. By Laura Regensdorf. Photograph by Joe Lingeman. 1. The Favorite. YSL Beauté Shimmer Rush Face Palette. Nothing perks up a royal complexion like a flushed cheek. This blush warrants palace intrigue. 2. Mary Poppins Returns. Lord Jones High CBD Gumdrops. If a spoonful of sugar was the original trick, today's medicine, the chill-inducing and squarely legal cannabinoid CBD, goes down smoothly in a tony confection. 3. Black Panther. Fenty Beauty Pro Filter Concealer. When Rihanna's line launched 40 shades of foundation, now 50 with concealer to match, it set an industry-wide bar for representation that reverberated all the way to Wakanda. Daniel Kaluuya wore it to last year's Oscars. 4. Boy Erased. Boy de Chanel Lip Balm. As ideas of masculinity shift, cosmetics brands are beginning to court the boys. 5. First Man, Vintage Apollo 11 Coin. Could a shiny memento of a national achievement be a mind-soothing salve in loony times? 6. Black Klansman, Barredo Nzinga Horn Comb. Rocking natural hair is a power move. This Afro pick was aptly named after an Angolan queen. 7. A Star is Born, Dr. Barbara Sturm Calming Serum. In honor of Gaga going makeup-free to play a star on the rise, here's a calming serum to keep the skin in tune. And 8. Crazy Rich Asians, Guerlain Rouge G Lipstick. Chic lipstick in a custom case, professorial black leather and blinged-out gold, means glamour for the whole family. now for a field trip. Keziah Weir gives us a look inside the writing room of Marlon James, whose new novel explores the nature of storytelling. Global Traveler, photographs by Ackerman and Gruber. Marlon James, author of the Booker Prize-winning novel A Brief History of Seven Killings, can write almost anywhere, except, he says, in his own apartment. I have a fully functional office at home that I've never stepped into. It has a computer, it has a printer, it has a scanner, and it has cobwebs. Instead, the Kingston, Jamaica-born writer bikes to Minneapolis's Stevens Square, where his workspace walls are lined with research for his Dark Star trilogy, a fantasy set in an otherworldly Africa. The much-anticipated first volume, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, is out this month. In the photos, I drew the maps for the book. Almost all those places are loosely based on kingdoms and cities I found in research, whether it's Old England or Timbuktu. This is a mountain fortress in Tigray, Ethiopia. It's a reminder for me that we had buildings of such magnificence in Africa, and we still do. This voodoo doll is from New Orleans. I hope he doesn't have any powers. I jot down plot points and character notes incessantly. I usually carry a notebook around with me. Ideas come everywhere. I can't imagine not reading while I'm writing. People say they don't want to be influenced. I'm like, you can only hope. Muji pens write really, really well. It's the rare pen I'll write with all the way to the end. I grew up in a noisy house, in a noisy town, in a noisy country. When I'm at the office, I immediately open the window so I can hear traffic. I need energy. I feed off energy. I don't know if I could handle silence.
Thank you.
Keziah Weir writes this commentary, Child's Play, on the eve of Sesame Street's 50th season, a look back at the star-studded visitors to America's happiest neighborhood. Photo illustration by Joanne Niborski. Shown here in the illustration, Sesame Street guest stars have included Carol Burnett, Stevie Wonder, Candace Bergen, Susan Sarandon, Lupita Nyong'o, and James Earl Jones. There are formative moments in every child's life that burrow into the subconscious and become the essential building blocks of life henceforth. First word, first step, first glimpse of celebrity. For more than 150 million children around the world each year, that early sprinkling of stardust comes courtesy of Sesame Street. Today's tots have seen Conan O'Brien gabbing about amphibians, and Lupita Nyong'o telling Elmo that skin comes in lots of beautiful shades and colors. And back when Stevie Wonder crooned with Grover, or Susan Sarandon got stuck in the rain with the Count, chances are it was your own first celeb sighting, too. The program's central tenets have hardly shifted since its pilot aired on PBS a half century ago, when Carol Burnett editorialized a cartoon to the delight of kids and parents alike. Over the years, audiences have come to expect Muppets mingling with celebrities, and it's become a cherished gig for the stars themselves. In a behind-the-scenes video, Macklemore grins as he tells Elmo that every rapper's dream is to make it on Sesame Street. In an on-set Instagram, a beaming John Legend records a message to his daughter alongside the cast of colorful characters. One also wonders whether the medium strengthens the message. Celebrities are famous for a reason, and even toddlers are not immune to their magnetic pull. A clip from a 1992 episode feels oddly familiar to me. Candace Bergen, clad in high-waisted trousers and an oversized blazer, taught my beloved Elmo how to conduct an interview. Ask me what my job is now. Ask me what I'm wearing. As the show nears episode 5000, it might be easier to list major personalities who haven't appeared. One glaring absence, given his forcible roots in the show's imagined New York setting, is Donald Trump. Though there is a character named Ronald Grump, a sleazy real estate tycoon set on destroying the neighborhood's charm with a high-rise made of trash cans. "I call it Grump Tower," he said. "What are we teaching our children?" has been a concern since TVs first found their way into living rooms. The answer offered by Sesame Street, now broadcast on both PBS and HBO, is simple yet aspirational. Reach for the stars, both human and metaphoric.
Thank you.
On the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, events. Shop stylish and sustainable wellness essentials. Eco-friendly living never looked this good. Fit for an on-the-go lifestyle, W&P's Porter Collection makes healthier, eco-conscious eating and drinking a stylish part of your everyday. From the Porter Bowl to the Porter Mug, the Porter Bottle and beyond, each product channels the aesthetic of high-quality homeware in a format designed for ultimate portability. Featuring lightweight ceramic, glass, or BPA-free plastic protected by a durable silicone wrap, this collection can withstand even the most hectic workday commute. Complete your set with the stainless steel Porter straws and feel good about swapping waste for wellness in your daily routine. Event: Vanity Fair and HBO's advanced premiere of Brexit. Vanity Fair and HBO co-hosted an advanced screening of a new film by HBO, Brexit, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Dominic Cummings, the leading strategist and architect of the Vote Leave campaign in the 2016 UK-EU membership referendum. The quick-witted drama explores the anatomy of a modern data-driven election campaign and the divisive figures that drove it from the shadows. The event was held at the Contemporary Whitby Hotel in Upper Midtown Manhattan. Vanity Fair Hive editor John Kelly introduced the film, providing color to the importance and timeliness of the story. Watch True Detective on HBO. The new season tells the story of a macabre crime in the heart of the Ozarks and a mystery that deepens over decades and plays out in three separate time periods. Mahershala Ali stars as Wayne Hayes, a state police detective from Northwest Arkansas. Carmen Ejogo and Stephen Dorff also star. Created by Nick Pizzolatto, True Detective airs Sundays at 9 p.m., on HBO. onto the fairground. With photographs by Dali Fayebshev, Walk This Way, Chanel invited Vanity Fair into Cece's Diner, a dreamt-up burger joint serving fashion with a side of fries, after the Métier d'Art show in New York by Kenzie Bryant. The party followed the annual celebration of Chanel craftsmanship, held at the Temple of Dendur in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Pharrell Williams played model for the Egypt-inspired collection in a gold tunic and pants. In the photos, Pharrell Williams, who recently designed a capsule collection for Chanel, walked in the show while Julianne Moore, Christy Turlington, Teresa Palmer, Liu Wen, and Rowan Blanchard looked on. Lily Rose Depp arrives at the after-party. Irina Schneitman and Tessa Brinsma. The Met is Karl Lagerfeld's favorite museum in New York because you have everything there, he has told Vanity Fair. Janelle finds her groove while the Seinfelds snag a booth. Hats off to Carl L. I love any art direction you can give, Jessica Seinfeld was overheard telling her husband Jerry as he snapped a photo of her. Rumsey Playfield in Central Park was transformed into Cece's Diner. Burgers, fries, and milkshakes were served from Airstream trailers and enjoyed in leather banquette booths. In the photos, Karl Lagerfeld, Penelope Cruz, and Stephen Gann. Janelle Monáe. Models changed into their off-duty looks to replenish with diner favorites. The annual show's finale was a blur of gold and knit as nearly 90 looks took a turn around the Temple of Dendur. Wenzhou and Lan Ali. Jessica and Jerry Seinfeld. Carlos Godoy, Tom Sachs, and Sarah Hoover. Alt-Delete. Even the most incorrigible deplorables, Alex Jones, Tommy Lahren, Candace Owens, have a shelf life. By James Walcott. Opening photo illustration by Oliver Monday. Oh, blather. Milo Yiannopoulos, Candace Owens, Gavin McInnes, Ben Shapiro, and Alex Jones. Shown here all gesturing and talking. Few sights offer smoother satisfaction than the crash and burn of high-decibel blowhards heedlessly gone off the rails, destroying their fortunes out of sheer dumb hubris. It's a folly as old as Greek myth, though the contemporary examples on display are of a stubbier nature. In the last year or so, some of the most storied names on the nationalist pro-Trump circuit have been reduced to roasted marshmallows because they refused to recognize that the rules of the game had changed. That after the Charlottesville white nationalist march, in which a counter-protester was killed, the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre, and other paroxysms of violence, hate speech was no longer going to be countenanced as performance art or a barbaric yawp of free expression. It was bad for democracy, bad for business. Feeling the pressure from users and advertisers, social media magnates, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and fundraising platforms, Patreon, GoFundMe, finally began to cut the lights and switch off the mics. It remains incredible and impardonable that the rantiest ogre of the lot, splenetic Alex Jones of InfoWars, was able to get away with the lies, smears, and not-so-conspiracy-mongering for as long as he did. He became so self-intoxicated that he convinced himself he was Hulk Unstoppable. Likewise, the dandy nihilist Milo Yiannopoulos peacocked as if nothing mortal could trim his luminescent feathers. A raging zealot, Laura Loomer was intent on becoming the agent provocateur. She interrupted a performance of Julius Caesar in Central Park, squawked about Uber and other car services hiring Muslim drivers, and confronted Democrats in a gotcha tactic she called loomering. Then she got loomered. None of the three took their social media banishment with Churchillian aplomb. Cupping his hands like a hog collar, Jones pursued Google CEO Sundar Pichai down the hall before a congressional hearing crying, "Google is evil! Google is evil!" until a security guard told him to stifle himself. Milo Y. made a martyr statement on Facebook lamenting his fallen condition. "I have lost everything standing up for the truth in America, spent all my savings, destroyed all my friendships, and ruined my whole life," and later tried to create a new income stream with Patreon account, offering access to him for $750 a month, only to have Patreon slam the lid. And then there was Loomer, who, wearing the yellow star of a Jewish subject under Nazi occupation and toting a megaphone, handcuffed herself to the front door of Twitter's New York headquarters and flung away the keys, demanding that her account be reinstated. Her defiant vigil was deflated by the blasé attitude of the police, who told her she could hang around as long as she liked. It was a cold November night, and Loomer and her bladder weren't up for the siege. After a few hours, the police cut her loose, another tantrum thrown for naught. Undeterred, Loomer brazened back into the news in January by hopping the fence of Nancy Pelosi's Napa Valley home and pitching a hinky-looking protest tent. She was let go with a warning, once again managing to avoid getting her trespassing butt arrested. These deplatformings and blackballings, along with those of Gavin McInnes, bearded patriarch of the Proud Boys, and Roger Stone, permanent Batman villain, have created room in the conservative opinion sphere for younger upstarts avid for franchise value. With many of them, you can see who their aspirational models are. Two of the most prominent, Ben Shapiro and Charlie Kirk, suggest Tucker Carlson mini-me's, white, spruce, glibly formulaic, and aglow with the confidence that comes from convincing yourself you possess mad skills in julienning the libs. A wunderkind who became a syndicated columnist at the age of 17, a prolific regurgitator of right-wing arguments of algorithmic predictability, former editor-at-large of Breitbart News, podcaster and vodcaster, Shapiro presents himself as a beetle-browed slayer of fashionable cant. Ben Shapiro destroys transgenderism and pro-abortion arguments. Ben Shapiro destroys Piers Morgan on gun control, boast video titles on his YouTube channel. Shapiro smirkily offered lefty political sensation Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a $10,000 donation to debate on his Howdy Doody talk show, which earned him a brisk rebuke. Just like catcalling, I don't owe a response to unsolicited requests from men with bad intentions. Trifling with AOC is a guaranteed way to get yourself scorched, something the right reflexively underestimating her seems so far unable to deduce. One major asset Shapiro possesses for future brand growth is that he is not a Trumpist, which offers him tactical maneuverability as the Trump presidency cheese melts. Not so Charlie Kirk. He's all in, covered in MAGA. Another whiz kid, still in his mid-20s, Kirk is the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA, a student activism movement that espouses free markets and limited government. But in the Trump era, these tenets are cast aside in service to the personality cult. The Meet the Founder page on the TPUSA site features Kirk interviewing Trump and being endorsed by Trump as a great warrior. Intellectually, Kirk may offer less fiber than Shapiro. His 2018 book, Campus Battlefield, How Conservatives Can Win the Battle on Campus and Why It Matters, blessed with a foreword by Donald Trump Jr., was composted by Adam Rubinstein in the Conservative Weekly Standard as a direct mail pitch bloated to book length. But the Weekly Standard is now defunct, and Kirk is still propagating, so I guess he wins, for now. Along with other promising lads, such as the excitable Brandon Straka, creator of the viral hashtag WalkAway campaign, devised to persuade Democrats to abandon their party, we mustn't neglect Ann Coulter copykittens, such as Tommy Lahren, another controversialist from the blonde retinue of Fox News. Younger, toothier, and blonder, recalling Pauline Kael's crack about Robert Redford's hair going beyond platinum into plutonium, Lahren aches to fill a Valkyrie role that Coulter won't relinquish. There's a Ryan Murphy miniseries in here somewhere. Ample opportunity awaits young African-American conservatives, the older sages having gotten stale, there being a limit to how many times you can recycle moldy platitudes from Thomas the Godfather of Sowell. Some acts, like femme duo Diamond and Silk, whose 2018 documentary, Dummycrats, is clotted with YouTube clips of the two appearing at Trump events before launching into a prolonged, futile campaign to confront Maxine Waters on camera, seem to be perpetually auditioning for reality TV. Others are making more studious efforts to assert themselves into the national dialogue, including teenage phenom C.J. Pearson, a high school junior who bills himself on his website as the left's youngest nightmare. Regardless of age, conservatives love to give themselves hobgoblin airs. Another candidate for worst nightmare is Candace Owens, the director of communications for Turning Point USA and a Trump idolater who caught the erratic fancy of Kanye West. "I love the way Candace Owens thinks," he tweeted. and immediately lofted from the ideological dais to the showbiz stage. For convenience, I've labeled these tweeters, activists, and soundbiters as conservatives, but many of them are postmodern self-merchandisers with no core principles apart from holy Ronald Reagan hand-me-downs that they pull out of the sock drawer now and then. Their political libido is animated by thirsty desire to own the libs and rile the snowflakes, a species of guerrilla warfare that achieves nothing lasting but keeps the friction going on social media and cable news. It's easier to keep mouthing away than do the actual hard work of running for office and engaging with real voters instead of one's fan base. More lucrative, too, what with book deals, speaking fees, merchandising, Patreon inflows. Oh well, grifter's gonna grift. It's the American way, but they would be advised to keep their wilder impulses holstered. The stunts and outrages that were permissible only a year ago won't fly now, and it's become a shorter trip to Palookaville for incorrigible deplorables. Just ask Alex Jones, if he ever stops yowling. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.